What a time, ladies and gentlemen. Golic and Wingo, ESPN Radio, ESPN2, presented by Progressive Insurance. All phone guests will join us on the Shell Penzoil Performance Line. Mike Golic Jr., Trey Wingo here. Jr., fresh off his celebratory performance at the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. Congratulations, man. I know that's something you've wanted to do for a long, long time.
Thanks, Trey. Yeah, it was a blast, and certainly thank you to everyone around here, to the Shea brothers, Rich and George, and everything they do with Major League Eating for letting me and Jason Fitz, who was our sideline analyst, be a part of all this. It was a blast. I am sporting the colors proudly today as I you know what? The only thing I was disappointed in coming off this weekend, and again, I got to see two world records, Joey Chestnut, 75 hot dogs and buns, Mickey Sudo, 48 and a half hot dogs and buns, the new women's record in this, beating Sonia Thomas's mark. Got to see all that. Everyone was so awesome. The eaters were all incredibly kind and great to deal with. The only thing I was disappointed in was my own hot dog consumption. I only had 4 hot dogs while I was there.
What?
Yeah. My car still smells like hot dogs, so it's a great reminder, but I am baffled that in that time period, I only managed to have 4 hot dogs. It feels like I didn't hold up my end of the bargain enough. So Hopefully if they will have me back, I will eclipse that goal next year and try and put forth a better effort.
And again, I brought this up to your attention. I think it was like 05 or 06. They actually asked me to do it. I'd already made plans like with my family, like to see my mom and dad, so I couldn't do it. But we could have had a generational hot dog thing going on, along with Adam Amin, who did it for years.
I was
going
to say, it would have been great to go back and look at like the pictures, like the early 2000s footage versus the 2020 footage. Yeah. Oh.
When I had hair color, it would have been a wonderful time.
When I had hair. Period. Would have been great.
Oh, I miss it. That would have been wonderful.
So we've got all that going on, which has led my hunger path down the I went down the ice cream truck rabbit hole.
I saw
here.
You putting out those pictures yesterday on
Dude,
Instagram.
Well, and so now like I got that. So I went with, and I had this conversation of what's everyone's go-to ice cream truck snack. It parked in front of the house here and basically dared me.
It was really, because people need to understand where we are. This was here or at your house? You're on the
This
house.
Was here.
Okay, this
was
here. Your parents live on a very quiet street.
It's a very quiet street.
There's only like 4 or 5 houses on the street. So it's not like a go-to beacon where you'd get a million people.
Our reputation is Fats Precise.
There it is. I was about to say.
It hunted me.
You guys are easy targets.
It hunted me like I was in the wild, and it just sat out there, and it knew eventually, like a moth to the flame, I would go out there. And so I asked people what their favorite ice cream truck. I went Choco Taco and the Sonic the Hedgehog, because I think anything with gumball eyes plays in all this one. Trey, I forgot about some real gems in here. Have you ever had the Snoopy popsicle?
I have not.
It's like a chocolate vanilla ice cream, and it's got like the chocolate back on it. I forgot about that.
So that's kind of like the Mickey Mouse ears popsicle at Disney World, right?
Yes. Okay. Very similar to that. I mean, just an elite snack treat. Ice cream sandwiches getting brought up. Push Pop. So a lot of great ones. At Golic and Wingo. Keep them coming.
Bomb Pop would always be my go-to. But you mentioned strawberry shortcake. And again, it's a fruit. So you're eating a treat and it's good for
you. We should put, like, we've talked about asterisks in sports.
Yeah.
Let's put the asterisk next to it's a fruit and the strawberry shortcake popsicle.
Should we come up with a list of the names of fruits that make you think you're, foods that you make you think you're eating because they're healthy, but they're really not, like the strawberry shortcake, like carrot cake.
I mean, listen, fruit by the foot is literally fruit that you're getting by the foot. I don't know what my daily like allotment of fruit that qualifies for, but it's by the foot, so it's got to be some pressure portion of that.
And it's not in any way just heavily sugar-based. So we got 3. I think we need 4 for a poll. So we got strawberry shortcake, fruit by the foot, carrot cake. Is there another one we're missing? Because we need to put that up on a poll.
We're going to figure that out coming up here, and we'll have a poll ready for you of non-fruit, fruit-based things that might get us to qualify them as fruits for our own well-being.
It gives you a pass because it's good. Meanwhile, we're trying to figure out what's going to happen in Washington with the name of the NFL franchise, because the story broke on Friday that the team is having an internal review to figure out what to do with the name. And the NFL says, we are in entire support of this. And FedEx and Nike, two big-time dollar sponsors, have basically said, yeah, we think we might need to change the name. So it finally seems like there is real momentum for something that's been discussed for a lot of years about the Redskins changing their team name.
And we had Brian Mitchell on this morning, who's a former running back for the team.
In the Ring of Fame.
In their Ring of Fame. Does work for NBC Sports Washington around there now. And talking about the reaction and what he expects from fans. And he says he believes this name change will ultimately be a benefit in that regard. Here was him.
I go with the latter. I think it's going to open it up for more people. And I asked the question on my radio show this week. Do you cheer for the name or do you cheer for the players? Do you cheer for the organization? You know, the name is not necessarily what somebody cheer for. I just think that's our way as Americans, where We're selfish. We want what we want no matter what it does to somebody else. And all these people that are saying, well, if the name changed, I'm going, well, you wasn't a fan anyway. I've never seen someone buy a jersey and put the name of the team on the back of it. They put the name of the players on the back of it. So if you love this organization and you see them changing for the better, and if they come out and start winning, the same people around here that had pride in that organization before is going to have pride moving forward.
I mean, he's right, but I will say we root for laundry in most situations. Like, if you're wearing our team's colors or our team's logo, then you're cool, even if we hated you when you were somewhere else.
Exactly, but I still think that's less tied to the name. Like, it's still going to be burgundy and gold around there. You're still going to be able to look out, see those colors, and have that identifier. It is trust among groups of people. It is tribalism at its core.
Yes.
Can I identify you as one of us?
Correct.
And you're still going to be able to identify everyone as fans of the Washington football team, even if it comes with a different name in all of this.
Yeah, and I do find it funny on some way, shape, or form that someone who is a diehard fan of this team and has put up with this years of losing, and they still consider themselves a fan, even though every year, for in recent memory, 4-12, 5-11, 6-10, 3, whatever it is, and then this is the line of demarcation where you're going to not be the fan of that team anymore? I find that curious.
So that's interesting with timing with another portion of this, because part of this is the financial pressure that has been put on Daniel Snyder to change the name. Well, we got the announcement over the weekend, or the report, I should say, according to the Washington Post, that there are 3 minority owners that are seeking to sell their shares because they are, quote, not happy being a partner with owner Daniel Snyder. Robert Rothman, Dwight Schar, and Frederick W. Smith are 3 businessmen who combined own about 40% of the team.
And as we point out, Frederick W. Smith is Fred Smith of FedEx. So that is big, big money.
They've hired an investment banking firm to undergo a search for possible buyers. This, according to the Washington Post. And this is according to shareholders who have talked to our own John Keim, said that Daniel Snyder felt like this had been a big surprise to Snyder because he considered them all to be friends. And we asked the question at the beginning of the show, why now if you're going to look at this situation? And I think we've come up with 2 answers that could be possible in this.
Correct. One of them is you're facing a very uncertain season in what may or may not happen in the NFL. And might be a good time to get out to mitigate potential losses if you feel like the NFL revenues are going to be down, or you're concerned about how long they're going to actually play.
Yeah, I would say what your outside finances look like. This could be an easy out to say, you know what, renewed fervor around this idea that Dan Snyder's not been the easiest guy to work with. We can cut bait and run now. With that as a backdrop that no one will question. The other thing that I wondered here is, because you also brought up uncertain times, it could be difficult to find buyers into pro sports teams right now, with all things considered. Maybe this internal review wasn't viewed as much of a slam dunk as we thought from the outside, where we thought, oh yeah, once you announce that, of course you're going to change the name. And so maybe these shareholders, including one of them coming from FedEx side, are using this to apply a little added pressure.
Correct.
Hey, if you're not all the way bought in on going through with this, we're out the door. Yeah. We're sick of having to deal with this. And so maybe another added level of financial pressure in this helps push this across the goal line.
And again, that you would be Dan Snyder, who has used the word never 1,000 times when talking about whether or not the name would actually be changed. Brian Mitchell said he believes that Daniel Snyder is finally getting to the point where he understands that. But then we brought up this point earlier. Like, this is what capitalism is. This is we'd all like to say, well, this is a moral compass, maybe, but it's an understanding of people who have a heavy investment in a certain thing, and they're sensing a change in consumers' opinions, and they want to protect their money. And the best way to protect their money is to apply financial pressure on someone to do the thing that they think is going to be the best thing for a return on their investment. And that is the essence of capitalism right there. What's best for my bottom line based on what the consumers are telling me?
And the interesting part about this is that normally that applies, and especially when you're talking about organizations, big corporations, because morality is something for people. It's not something for organizations. The weird part about this is, and Mina Kimes brought this up last week, is this all goes back to not an organization, but one person.
Correct.
It's Daniel Snyder. And we all spent, as she pointed out, the last week of our lives and the last weekend of our life trying to psychoanalyze one guy. that we don't know all that well. Like, we know his public perception. We know the way that we've dealt with him in public. But you're basically trying to psychoanalyze him, because ultimately it's going to be his Daniel Snyder felt either a change of heart enough, which none of us believe is the case, or enough outside pressure to actually do this. And in a time where, as you pointed out in the beginning of the show, we've seen a state change their flag and NASCAR remove a flag from coming to its track at any point in time, we should have guessed that maybe this would have been easier than we gave it credit for. But because it's one guy, it's sort of a wild card. Because predicting any one person is a difficult thing to do.
And then that leads to what happens next. And you heard Ron Rivera, the head coach, say, hey, we've come up with a couple of really interesting names, including one that honors the military and also honors Native Americans. Well, that's where it gets a little tricky. Here's Crystal Echo Hawk, the founder and executive director of Illuminative, on Sunday morning on ESPN Radio, talking about who should be involved if they're having this discussion about changing the name, and they're throwing about the idea of trying to honor Native Americans in the process.
It's absolutely imperative. And they talk about this review, but there needs to be transparency in this review. There absolutely needs to be a working group of Native American experts. And the people that have been leading this movement for decades, you need to have a diverse coalition of Native leaders at the table with the team and the league, because not only does there need to be a full rebrand, right, and do there needs to be a transparent process around all of this, but I believe there truly needs to be an apology and a real genuine apology from the team and the league, because they have silenced and disregarded Native people for decades on this. And if they really want to do this right, if they really want to stand true to standing up against racism and doing what's right, then everything from this review process on needs to be done in the right way. And that is making sure that Native people are at the table and it's a transparent process.
I don't know if the apology's coming. I mean, that would be a remarkable 180 for Daniel Snyder.
And remember, that was kind of the remarkable 180 we got from Roger Goodell in the league office. Correct. When that video got put out. Like, that was something that we did not think we would ever get, and we got it almost immediately after the players spoke up and voiced their concerns.
Yes.
So that is a very real thing to expect, I think, especially, again, given the current landscape.
Yeah.
You can demand those things right now.
Well, it certainly seems like sports has been able to push the agenda of a lot of things going forward, albeit tied to money. Let's be clear. Two of the reasons that the state flag changed in Mississippi was the SEC said, we're not holding any more championships in that state, which denied the state dollars. And one of the best players on Mississippi State, Kylan Hill, the running back, said, I don't think I can represent this state anymore. And if one of your best running backs isn't there, that means your team's not going to be as good. And that means you're not going to win as many games. You're not going to potentially go to a bowl game. You're not going to sell as many tickets. And guess what? There's a financial repercussion there as well.
There is, but it was started because people decided, whether it was members of those leagues, members of the league brass, or the players that we've seen in some instances, they decided my morality here with my power in this system is going to dictate what happens going forward now in this. And what you heard there from Crystal Echo Hawk was just this kind of same idea that we have heard from women in the past when it's come up in the NFL, wanting to have better representation and voices heard throughout this process. Certainly recently, black athletes being made known, hey, probably start consulting us on stuff. If you're going to take so much from black culture and have a sport that benefits so much from black bodies, maybe listen to us a little bit more. Now you've got Daniel Snyder and all these other people talking about honoring Native Americans. Native American leadership is essentially saying, give us a seat at the table then. If you're so concerned about this idea of honoring us going forward, or thought that the name was honoring to begin with, give us a say in how that happens from now on. And I think that's what we've seen over everything that's gone on, is the importance of representation and actually listening to people. If you're going to discuss the issues that you claim to care about surrounding various groups and various minority groups, the least you can do is invite those groups in, invite leadership in, and listen to what they've got to say. And that's all that's being asked for in this situation.
And I think it's very important for us to be clear on one point here. It's not someone else saying, hey, we need to find a way to honor Native Americans with the mascot. It's not you and I sitting here saying that. That came from the head coach. That came from the team itself. So don't throw that on anybody but the person who brought it up.
Well, and that's what Washington's organization, that's what Daniel Snyder and company have been saying for years, that this name is meant to honor Native Americans. And you basically have Native American leadership there saying, we'll decide what honors us. Like, that's not for you, Daniel Snyder, or anyone else with that team to decide.
And then it leads to another interesting offshoot of this. What happens to other team names, whether it's the Cleveland Indians, the Atlanta Braves, the Kansas City Chiefs, the defending Super Bowl champs. We know the Cleveland Indians came out with a statement over the weekend as well, saying we are looking at an internal review at our situation and what we want to be going forward. And Terry Francona, longtime friend of the show, has been on forever, and his stock answer used to be, we're never trying to be disrespectful, but he said, I don't think in this day and age that's good enough anymore, and I think we need to take a look at that.
It would be wise if you are a sports team with a Native American mascot right now to understand this will not end with Washington. They have been the most notable example because their name is quite literally a racial slur, but that will not, it will not stop. As we've seen, everyone is coming to try and right all this. And it would be better and it would probably be easier for the organizations involved to get out ahead of this now that they've seen what's coming.
Yeah, and the Atlanta Braves have released a statement on Twitter basically saying we feel comfortable with where we are, and that's fine.
Yeah, unless you're the Braves who said, or nah, good luck with that.
Yeah, so we'll see how that ends up for everybody else going forward. Here's what we know. Washington is undergoing a review, and they're going to try to come up with something that I think will have the R in it in one way, shape, or form, because that's such an intrinsic logo. And as you said, the burgundy and gold will still be a part of that. So that can resonate with fans, and that's something they can hold on to.
Yeah, it pops up every time we have this discussion.
Fighting
like
Irish?
People do the Fighting Irish thing all the time. Like, yeah, you know what? The colors would still be blue and gold. The university would still be Notre Dame. My experiences with the team, as a part of the team, as a fan of the team, are all tied to events, the people they played for, and ultimately the school that represents it. The mascot is a small, small part of that, that to me is always cosmetic. And it is something that you go back in Notre Dame's history when they had a different mascot before. Everyone knows the history. It's talked about in the history, so we're not erasing it. It's just not celebrated anymore. It's not celebrated in the same way. And that wasn't even a racist mascot. It was just a dog, and it's not a dog anymore. It's the leprechaun now. And if they did away with that, people would still know that for a long amount of time, that was the mascot. And that was what we had at the time, and here is why we chose to change it. It is still a part of the history. It's just not one that people celebrate anymore, and that's exactly the way it can go in Washington. No one's erasing your history. They're just asking you to have a mascot that's name isn't a racial slur, and that feels like a very low bar to clear.
So we'll see what happens going forward. Again, that review is underway. Lots more to get to, including what's trending, and that, Junior, is where you shine.
That is where I shine.
Because you're a trendy dude.
Let's get you caught up on what's trending. We mentioned Major League Eating had the Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest, and Joey Chestnut and Mickey Sudo both broke records. Joey Chestnut consumed 75 hot dogs and buns and won by a record 33 hot dogs and buns in that contest. He could have sat out the final 5 minutes and 35 seconds and still managed to win. Mickey Sudo consumed a woman's record 48 and a half hot dogs and won by 30 and a half. She could have sat out the last 6 minutes and 30 seconds and still won. Joey Chestnut, by the way, consumed nearly 21,750 calories in an event for Major League Eating that is obviously a huge, huge part of the 4th of July every year. Meanwhile, NASCAR. Kevin Harvick turned up the pressure on Denny Hamlin late in the Brickyard 400, and he gets a win there. Harvick beat out Matt Kenseth off the final restart to pull away for the win. Harvick won for the 53rd time to move within one of tying Lee Petty for 11th on NASCAR's career list. Quote, we had a great tire wear today, so I was able to really push my car as hard as I could. I was able to push him a little harder, him being Denny Hamlin, the last run than earlier in the race when the sun went down. The track was cooling and the speeds were going up in the turns. Denny Hamlin, by the way, with 7 laps to go, unfortunately had some issues with the front right tire and ended up going into the wall. He was fine, but not able to finish the race. And in the UFC, Kamaru Usman and Jorge Masvidal agreed to the UFC 251 bout coming up this weekend. Both Usman and Masvidal, who will be replacing Gilbert Burns, who you can read his Twitter account, said, I'm not feeling well, one can assume what happened there, had Correct. To pull out of the event. Now, Usman and Masvidal both have passed their initial COVID-19 test, so now the timeline looks as follows. 3 massive obstacles were in the way. Negotiations, signing, and that first COVID test. They've passed all those. Now, they're going to fly to Abu Dhabi, take a second COVID test at the hotel, quarantine, and pass that. Then take a third COVID test, quarantine, and pass that. The weigh-in would be Friday, and then there would be a 4th and final COVID test to pass after the weigh-ins leading up to the fight. That all gets you caught up on what is trending.
We all want this fight, right? I mean, this is the one we're all looking for. And again, Masvidal's taking it on a week, but again, his camp has said, hey, he trains all the time. And if you see Jorge Masvidal, he looks like a guy who trains all the time.
Yeah, so this was the fight that everybody wanted in all of this one. And you remember going all the way back to the Super Bowl this February, there was that altercation between these two guys at Radio Row there
right
that
in
got
front
on
of our booth.
Today, right in front of our booth. And so we know a lot of the hang up on this ended up being money. That was why the fight wasn't originally taking place. Jorge Masvidal thought he was worth a lot more in this, and when that wasn't going his way, broke off negotiations, and so they set Gilbert Burns for the fight. Here's Dana White, UFC president, talking about what it took to actually get this once and for all.
If you look at the 20-year history, this kind of stuff happens. When you get into negotiations for fights, these things happen. Gilbert Burns has been on a tear, was consistently fighting and wanted to continue to fight, and he was the number one contender, so Gilbert Burns made sense. Obviously, Masvidal has become a massive star over the last year and a half, and that's the fight that the people want to see. So when Burns fell out, we got in a room and figured Masvidal out.
And got in a room and figured it out means right? They probably had to pay him a lot of money.
That's it, right? We got in a room and figured it all out. Basically, we wrote a bigger check than we thought we were going to have to for Jorge Masvidal because we had Gilbert Burns ready.
Yeah, I was going to say that in situations unforeseen for the UFC in these uncertain times, we know everything going on with the virus, created a lot of leverage where, all right, you needed a fighter. Jorge Masvidal was the one you wanted there to begin with. And now, I don't know if he ended up getting exactly what he wanted. We'll wait to see if the figures come out on this. But you have to imagine they had to pay up to get now what could be a matchup that sets up like the next big UFC star. Masvidal was the fighter of the year last year. He's got the BMF belt. And just in general, he's a big, loud, abrasive personality, right? Like, he is Miami through and through. I know the Lebatar guys have him all the time. And he's super entertaining when he's with them. I'm just hoping Stu Gotz gets to go to Abu Dhabi. Like, I don't know how we make that work. I don't know if Stu Gotz is going to pass anyone's test because even if he doesn't have coronavirus, just in general, his overall aura might not be one that in a disease-free environment you necessarily want. But overall, I'd really love to see him in that corner.
Listen, if you can't,
I love you, Stu.
If you can't get to Yas Island, then Stu Gotz needs to get to Yas Island. One of the two of you needs to be there.
We need what was the former greatest Sunday morning radio show in ESPN history and Weekend Observations represented there somehow, some way. Stu Gotz in the corner, Jorge Masvidal, collision course.
How many years was that show on?
One and a half.
Gotcha. Okay.
But it was a hell of a year and a half.
18 months, baby. 18 months.
That was all people could handle. Then they needed a long cigarette break after that bout of Sunday morning goodness, I tell you what.
So we'll see what happens going forward. We'll have Ariel Helwani join us in just about 40 minutes or so. But coming up next, we'll tell you why the city of New York collectively held their breath when it comes to a beloved sports franchise over the weekend. We'll get to that after this.
After this word from Grainger. As you get back to business, Grainger wants to remind you that small things can make a big difference, like marking safe distances with floor tape and posting reminders to wash your hands. And as always, Grainger is there to help. Offering supplies and solutions for every industry, free access to product specialists, 24/7 support, safety recovery guides, all that and more. It's part of their commitment to help you adapt and recover in these challenging times. Learn more by visiting Grainger.com/recovery. Grainger for the ones who get it done. Back after this, Golic and Wingo.
All right, Golic and Wingo here with you on a Monday morning. Hope you had a great 4th of July weekend. Mike Golic Jr., Trey Wingo here with you. So we saw a lot of teams getting back into action at their facilities over the weekend in baseball as they get ready to ramp up and try to begin spring training and then get set for what we believe will be the start of the Major League Baseball season in just a couple of weeks. But there was a scary moment that you heard alluded to in the rejoin there as Giancarlo Stanton. Kind of interesting, ironic, coincidental, whatever you want to call it, that Giancarlo Stanton, who got rocked in the face a couple of years ago by a pitch and still has that big sort of batter or thing on his batting helmet.
That sort of shield as a part of his right. helmet to protect him. Because that was grisly. That was, you're talking the orbital bone, all those things that are
awful. It was
horrific.
Awful, and it was a line drive off the bat of Giancarlo Stanton that knocked out Masahiro Tanaka, and thankfully, he's just being dealt with a mild concussion. The CT scans came back negative. So for more on that and all the things related to baseball, we're glad to be joined out by Marla Rivera, our ESPN Yankee reporter. And Marla, that was a scary moment at Yankee Stadium. It certainly looked like it could have been much worse for Tanaka.
No, absolutely, gentlemen. And one of the things that happened is that the Yankees were one of the teams that started a little bit later. Almost everyone started their, quote-unquote, summer camp workouts or spring training 2.0, whatever it is, the new phrase that they're using for this. And it was almost every team started on Friday, and the Yankees started the workouts actually on Saturday, and we came in around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And as we went through the very, very enhanced screening process, that they have for all the, you know, the limited amount of members of the media be at Yankee Stadium on Saturday afternoon. As we're walking in, we sit down, we set our computer, and at that moment, the simulated game is about to start. And about 10 minutes in, this happens to Masahiro Tanaka, just a very, very scary moment. Unfortunately, I have been at stadiums when this has happened before, and it is one of those moments that everyone just holds their breath.
Yeah, absolutely. So best case scenario for him. So Marley, I'm just curious, as one of the few that's allowed in the stadium, can you tell us about the procedures and protocols that you had to go through to get into Yankee Stadium?
We have pretty strict ones, obviously not to the level of the players. What happens in this very, very, very long document that Major League Baseball and the Players Association agreed upon, which is called the 2020 operations manual, and it's well over 100 pages, and we all had to read it at ESPN, so we've seen all the details. For the players, it's extremely great. Like, there's different tiers, and we have zero access to the members of this called tier one and tier two in every team. They're never near us, but we are the tier three, and this tier three has a certain process. You have to stand in line, you have to get your temperature checked twice. You have to sign a document every single day where they ask you, you know, all these health questions. There's a very serious health questionnaire. And every single day you have to go in and pick up a credential, which is extremely different from how it works in a regular season. Reporters that cover a team have what it's called the season credential. And you can actually go in and out. And this is just very, very controlled, because at this point, according to this operations manual, only 35 people can be in the stadium as media members covering each one of these practices.
Well, that's crazy, especially for a city like New York.
Yes, absolutely. As we're talking to Marley Rivera with us, our ESPN Major League Baseball reporter. So, Marley, I saw you tweet on Saturday that two players for the Yankees had tested positive, DJ LeMahieu and Luis Sessa. Has there been any other updates as far as the testing, the players, or any of the members of the organization involved with that?
The only update was yesterday from Aaron Boone, who actually said the testing was complete, and those were the only two positives. So at this point, the Yankees are saying, they're stating, that out of their entire staff and, you know, members of the staff and players that are currently at Yankee Stadium working out, that only these two players, like you mentioned, pitcher Luis Sessa and, of course, you know, superstar DJ LeMahieu, the two of them are still at home. And it is worth noting that these two players tested positive before getting to New York. So it wasn't part of the intake testing, which is this 3-day process that every single player and staff member has to go through. And then these guys tested at home positive. So they're self-isolating at home. So Sessa and LeMahieu haven't been at Yankee Stadium at all. So at this point, this is where we are. Just these only two players are supposedly the ones who tested positive for COVID-19.
And Marley, just for everyone who's wondering and might not know, for them to rejoin the team, what has to happen now that they've self-isolated and they're quarantining at home?
There's a very, very detailed process that is about 6 pages on that document that I talked about. Of all the things that need to happen before these players are allowed, you know, to rejoin the team. To just summarize it in a very simple way, there are 3 rounds of testing and 2 rounds where you have to give, you know, negative to these particular coronavirus tests. So there's just a whole process where you have to test negative twice, and then you get continued to be tested. And then after that, you get isolated, and then you can rejoin the team. So it is really incredible the amount of, you know, guidelines and protocols that have to be followed and need to be followed at this unprecedented time.
Well, thinking of things that need to happen. Debbie Trout, Mike Trout's mother, put out a picture of him working out with a mask on and said, "If Mike Trout can work out with a mask on, you can wear a mask going to the grocery store. Hashtag wear a mask." And Marley, Mike Trout is one of many people who is going through the process, but still has major doubts about whether or not this will actually be a success. We heard the great sound from Sean Doolittle of the Nationals basically saying, hey, sports should be a reward for a functioning society, and we're having massive outbreaks way more than what we had when we shut the whole thing down in March. So where are you engaging the temperature, for lack of a better term, on some of the big players in the game that have real concerns about whether or not this is going to be a feasibility?
It feels like this balance can tip any time, that a lot of them are still considering it. And I really appreciated the sincerity, right, that came out of someone like Mike Trout, who is, you know, considered the face of the game and the, you know, one of the best players of our time. And him saying straight up, you know what, I'm going to have a kid. You know, my wife is pregnant with her first child. This is an incredibly important time in my family. And I don't know that I'm ready, you know, to kind of put them in jeopardy, which is what he believes. So then at this point, Mike said, I am here. I'm working out, but I don't know if I'm going to finish this whole, you know, preseason process and this 60-game abbreviated season. And we hear that a lot from a lot of players who are saying, I'm here, but I just don't know what I'm going to do. We just saw David Price walk away from $11 million, right? Saying, I want to spend time with my family. And this is one thing that people have to remember. The average age in Major League Baseball is in the late 20s. A lot of these guys are starting their first families. And we just know about Gerrit Cole just had his first baby on June 30th. I mean, this child is barely a week old, little Caden Gerrit Cole. And Gerrit has said, you know, we decided, my wife Amy and I, that we were going to do this. And it is a very, very personal decision. Just imagine having your first child. But then again, Gerrit is one of those competitors that says, you know what, the Yankees did sign me to a record-setting $324 million deal, so I am going to give him the best I can. And I also think the Yankees do know that they're one of the favorites this season. And in a short season, they can certainly take whatever people believe is going to be, you know, some sort of World Series title in this abbreviated 60-game season.
ESPN MLB reporter Marley Rivera with us on the Shell Pennzoil Performance Line. And there is that baseball element. There's the competitive element to this.
Yes.
And so I'm curious, you mentioned you had the simulated game starting when this all happened with Masahiro Tanaka. I'm curious, though, as someone who's around this when things are normal, seeing it now, how comfortable did the players look getting back and trying to actually go through baseball activities with all this as a backdrop?
You know, it's almost something that obviously, as we mentioned before, you know, when we first started talking, our access to the player is very limited, so we actually can't see them from very close. But we do, you know, we have our binoculars and we take a look at them. And they look pretty normal. Like, it's almost like the weird part is the fact that they don't touch. And that it's really interesting. Every once in a while, someone will make the mistake of do a fist bump, and you can kind of see their fear in their face, right? Or make the mistake in that document that I talked to you guys about. It actually outlines the fact that you can't spit on the field and things like that. And then you'll see them, you know, do things like that because it's a natural behavior. So that's the one thing that you see. They feel a little bit uncomfortable with all these rules and regulations where you really can't touch your teammates. You have to be, you know, your locker has to be 6 feet away from each one of them. And that's the part that a lot of them have talked about. A lot of them, you know, a lot of sports we always talk about, and the reason why we love sports is this camaraderie, right? And this whole, you know, thing that happened between a team and they create this spirit of competition. It almost feels that that's fractured a little bit because they can't establish, you know, this kind of spirit of competition that we're used to. They sort of jout around all the time and play around and jump at each other. And not seeing that, it's kind of interesting, actually, as a media member who is so used to seeing these guys interact with each other.
Yeah, I mean, the odds of one player going through a game without spitting, let alone an entire team going through an entire season without spitting, is a 0% chance that that's going to happen. But it is a weird place we're in, and we'll see as baseball tries to begin the process of starting a season, which, again, is so much different than what the NHL and the NBA are doing in trying to finish a season in a pandemic. Marley, as always, we appreciate the time. Thank you so much for your insights this morning.
It is my pleasure, gentlemen. Stay safe and wear your mask.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Marley.
Great advice.
It doesn't seem like it's that difficult, yet somehow it is.
It's really not that hard.
So because of that, would it be better off if no sports were played? Hear why one NBA veteran thinks that might be a valid point. We'll get to that after this.
After this word from Pennzoil, not all motor oils are created the same. Motor oil made from crude oil contains impurities, but Pennzoil synthetic motor oils, they're made from natural gas. Its base oil is 99.5% free from impurities. It gives you unbeatable engine protection, so next time you get an oil change, ask for Pennzoil. The proof is in the Pennzoil based on Sequence 4A wear testing using SAE 5W30, a respected NBA veteran with a solution that not a lot of people are going to want to hear. Back after this, it's Golic and Wingo.
I trust the NBA that in the bubble, we're going to be in a safe environment.
You just never thought you'll be in a situation such as something like this. So, you know, it's hard to process at times.
Golic and Wingo here on ESPN Radio. Get to one sharpshooter in a second who had a very interesting take on what might be coming up for sports in general, what could and what should happen in all this one. But speaking of sharpshooters, I wanted to ask you this one, Trey. We put this up on Twitter last night, at Golic and Wingo. So, my thoughts exactly. You get one shot. You can make a layup, a free throw, a shot from the top of the key, a wing three-pointer, a corner three. or a half court shot, the prices on this are different. Yeah. So if you make
as they should be.
Yeah, you get one shot, you can make a layup, you'll get $50,000. A free throw gets you $100,000. Top of the key gets you $500,000. A wing three-pointer gets you $750,000. A corner three gets you $1 million. And a half-court shot gets you $3 million. Now, I believe analytically, your best bang for your buck on this would be the corner three, right?
I don't know.
Well, I mean,
not for me.
Like, analytically, the corner three outside of a layup is like the most efficient shot you can hit relative to everything else.
Well, that's the most efficient shot for an NBA player or a skilled basketball player.
Well, I guess I just mean,
for me, that would not be the play. The play for me would decide between either the sure thing of a layup for $50,000 or the 50-50 shot of a free throw for $100,000. That's where I'm at.
Let's put it this way. If I'm shooting beyond a layup, I'm going to follow the analytics on this, which would tell me go for the corner three next, because all the rest of it, in my mind, I have just as good a chance at missing a free throw shot as a non-NBA player missing a free throw. Like, God, if you shoot from the top of the key or a wing three-pointer, you are a full-blown sucker.
Yeah.
Full-blown sucker.
I agree.
Because you can get the same, like, it's the same thing. I mean, this is quite literally what we see in analytics. Like, you can take those that are all going to get you 3 points from beyond the arc, or you could take the shortest version of that shot and get $1 million as opposed to going under that. No brainer.
Yeah, I'm taking the sure thing. I'll probably
100%.
Yeah. Like, for me personally, could I make a sure $50,000 or maybe a 60% chance at $100,000? Maybe I'll live on the edge and go for the free throw, but that's about it.
Yeah, no, listen, I'm taking the layup. And I'm
right?
Not
I mean,
$50,000 is a lot of money.
$50,000 for just doing this?
Yeah.
I'm good.
But, like, this gets interesting when you get to the weekend warriors, the guys that are used to playing in the Y back in the day who feel like they got game and all of a sudden a corner three might be more within their reach.
I feel like Pat McAfee would be all in on the corner three because you've seen the videos he posts up of, like, I'm ready to play. I feel like in any situation he feels really good about the corner three.
That is true. So the at Golic and Wingo, you can check that out. We posted that last night. Interested to get everyone's answer on this. We're presented by Progressive Insurance. And speaking of corner threes,
yes.
So J.J. Redick went on Good Morning America this morning with Robin Roberts, and the only subject that there is to really talk about, what the hell are we going to do, the restart, everything,
correct,
came up on this. Here is what J.J. Redick was asked by Robin Roberts, and a very interesting answer from a respected NBA veteran.
What do you say to those who feel that nobody should be playing at this point, J.J.?
I think they have a valid point. I've said this all along in all these debates about whether we should be playing, whether so-and-so player should play, whether I should play. I think there's no right answer, and I think there's no wrong answer. I think there's truth in everybody's feeling right now. This is an unprecedented time in our country. This is an unprecedented time for nearly every sports league. I think you have to go back to World War II to find this level of disruption for sports league. So this is something we're all experiencing in real time. We all can make those decisions. I don't think it's wrong to say we shouldn't play. We're going to try to play. We're trying to make the best of a bad situation. I think our leadership at the league office with Adam Silver, our leadership with our union, Michelle Roberts, Chris Paul, Garrett Temple, they've done an amazing job in trying to create an environment where we can go play basketball and, as best we can, only worry about basketball. But that's obviously going to be very difficult.
It is going to be very difficult. And I think JJ's being very honest there when he's saying no one can say with any certainty how this is going to play out. We're going to give it a shot. We're going to give it a shot and see what happens. And he's right. You could make a – Andrew Brandt put this out on Twitter. He used to work for us, now does great stuff. I think he's with the Villanova Business School. Does a great job. Former president of the Packers. He put out a tweet weeks ago, which I think summed it up best. If it was just about the health and safety of the players, none of these contact sports would be played. But there is an economic thing to this that we're all trying to figure out, and that's, where's the line? What are we comfortable with in terms of keeping things going forward versus the risk of what may be a disastrous scenario?
Yeah, it's always been a three-pronged approach in my mind, because the other part of this is the competitive part of it, where, yes, there's obviously a lot of money on the line, and maybe in a lot of instances less than these guys are used to looking at something like Major League Baseball. But the proximity to a championship, like the team that you're on and the chance that you've got to win.
And that's the interesting thing about David Price, because David Price, you heard Milo Rivera, his prorated salary for this year was going to be $11 million. Well, he's got two more years left at $32 million on his contract, and I think he was paid $30 the last couple of years for the Boston Red Sox. So in a vacuum, when you hear someone like David Price say, hey, for a team that has a chance to win a championship, the Dodgers and Yankees are the co-favorites at plus 350, I believe, the last time we checked. To win the World Series, should we get to one, although Buster Olney doesn't think we will at 0%, separate issue entirely. You know, he's deciding $11 million isn't worth it because he's going to make $64 million over the next 2 years and is in the middle of a seven-year, $217 million contract. And he has the luxury of making that choice. And God bless him for having that luxury, because he's earned it by what he has accomplished and the things that he has proven he is worth in that sport. So there's a sliding scale for everybody on this.
And I think what you brought up on the idea, if it was just on the well-being of the people involved, you're seeing that play out in college athletics, because you're seeing places where the football programs do not drive the revenue that funds the rest of the athletic department, that funds parts of the university, those places are likely going to decide it's not worth it. You're seeing it at the D2 level. You're probably going to see it in the Ivies to an extent here versus what you'll see at the D1 Power 5 level of these schools that know without this sport, we will capsize. They're going to press on, and come hell or high water, it's at least going to start. It feels like that's the clearest example of exactly what you're talking about.
Right. It's what everyone is willing to risk versus the money that's involved. Coming up next, change seems to be coming to the nation's capital. What effect will it have on the rest of the sports landscape? Because you're right, Junior, this isn't a one-off. We'll get back to that next.